KPCW News time is 8:06. It was kind of overcast as I was driving into the studio this morning. Let's see what we got coming up in our forecast. Here's a report from Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday. It's time for the Wasatch Back forecast for your Friday moving into the weekend. And we're looking at a mixture of clouds and sunshine as we go throughout the area for your Friday afternoon. Park City, we're going to be seeing partly cloudy skies with a chance of some afternoon showers and thunderstorms developing. High temperatures in Park City only climbing to around the low 80s this afternoon. For the Heber Valley, we're going to keep it partly cloudy as well. We also will have a chance of a few afternoon isolated showers and thunderstorms developing. High temperatures there into the mid to upper 80s. As we go into your weekend, we start to dry things back out again, but we'll keep an isolated storm chance in the forecast for you in Park City for your Saturday with highs still in the low 80s. The Heber Valley will see those highs in the upper 80s to near 90 with partly cloudy skies. We are mostly sunny skies by the time we get towards your Sunday as that dry air takes back over. High temperatures will be into the mid 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing to around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. Now, moving into next week, we've got high pressure taking back over. So you know what that means. Dry conditions. Also, though, we'll start to see those winds picking up. So that's going to lead to that critical fire threat once again returning as we get towards the beginning of next week. But otherwise, we're looking at lots of sunshine for your Monday. Highs in the mid-80s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Moving into your Tuesday, look for plenty of sunshine. Highs will jump into the mid to upper 80s. In Park City, we'll see those highs in the low to mid-90s for the Heber Valley. And we're going to pretty much stay on the warm and dry side through most of next week with mostly sunny to partly sunny skies. Rain chances slim to none across the area as high temperatures will be into the mid to upper 80s in Park City and will be in the low to mid 90s for those daytime highs over towards the Heber Valley. So not much in the way of rain chances after your Friday afternoon, but a pretty decent chance of those scattered storms developing as we get into your Friday afternoon. Watch out for some of those heavier downpours. That's a look at your latest forecast, the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Monica Schaefer. She's involved with the reconstituted Park City, or Wasatch Back, League of Women Voters. Then I'll speak with Kempsey Gardner housing expert Dejan Eska. We'll be talking about the state of the housing market here in the Wasatch Back and across the state. We're going to finish our hour by talking about pests. We're going to be speaking with Brian Stevens, the Mosquito Abatement District Manager. Stay tuned. Let's do a little bit of local news. National Olympic leaders are in Utah this week talking about how to capitalize on the state's Olympic legacy. KPCW's Christine Weller reports part of the goal is to improve Team USA's performance in future Winter Games.
5 years ago, Kelly Skinner from the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee started a collaboration with the eight Olympic winter sport national governing bodies, the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, and the Olympic Regional Development Authority in Lake Placid. The goal of the collaboration is to improve Team USA's performance in major international competitions, including the 2026 Olympic Games in Milan Cortina, French Alps in 2030, and Salt Lake City, Utah in 2034. This year, the collaboration met at Utah's 2034 Olympic venues for the Winter Sport National Governing Body Conference. At the Utah Olympic Oval Thursday, Skinner said the goal is to make Team USA winter athletes shine.
We want Team USA to be successful on that field of play, and there's a lot that it takes to get there, especially in a nation that is not naturally a winter sport nation. We're a summer sport nation.
There are eight national governing bodies for winter sports compared to 37 for summer sports. Skinner said Utah created, quote, hotbeds of opportunity by preserving and using 2002 Olympic venues, as well as inspiring the next generation of Olympians.
The culture that's been created here in this state, in terms of how athletes are being introduced, kids are being introduced to the opportunities of winter sport, I haven't seen that anywhere.
Aaron McGuire, USA Bobsled and Skeleton CEO and National Governing Body Council Vice Chair, said a good example of this is Utah native Keisha Love. She competed in high school and then collegiate track and field when a coach introduced her to bobsled. Love quickly went on to become a world champion, and McGuire said she couldn't have done it without the Utah Olympic Park and Utah Olympic Oval facilities in Park City and Salt Lake City.
In winter sport, we're limited with the facilities. And so to have these venues, the support teams that are in place are critical for the success of Team USA.
Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton noted Utah's facilities don't need any major improvements before the 2034 Games, and that has been purposeful. The venues host national competitions, and athletes and recreationists regularly use the facilities as well.
We have a very rigorous schedule of capital improvements that we have been doing for the last 10 years, and we have our forecast for now through 34.
He said the state helps with some improvements, but some venues, like ski resorts, fund upgrades on their own. One capital improvement the group identified during its visit was the bobsled track at the Utah Olympic Park. Hilton said the roof and shading system needs to be redone before the 2029 Bobsled World Championships. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Monica Schaefer is the driving force behind the revitalization of the Wasatch-backed League of Women Voters. She's joining me in the studio this morning. Good morning, Monica. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
So, Monica, let's start with a little bit. For people who don't know much about the League of Women Voters, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I have memories of my mother hosting League of Women Voters meetings in the early 1960s in our living room. Can you share a bit about the history and purpose of the League of Women Voters?
Absolutely. So the League of Women Voters was formed in 1920, about 6 months before women actually earned the right to vote. And I have similar memories of my mom in the 1970s hosting similar events in my living room as well. So yeah, the purpose of the league is to educate voters, to empower voters, and to advocate for voter rights across the country. We are a nonpartisan, which means we don't advocate for or against any candidate or political party. We're a grassroots organization, and we just work to protect and expand voting rights and ensure everybody in our country is represented in our democracy.
Okay. When did the Wasatch Back last have an active chapter here?
So there was a chapter here years ago. It went online, kind of underground, as many organizations did during the pandemic, and they were mostly just, you know, kind of talking through Zoom meetings. The head of that chapter moved away a year and a half ago, and we didn't have anything active in this community for a while. I joined the Salt Lake chapter of the League of Women Voters about a year ago, and they are super active. There are tons of wonderful, extremely smart women working down there for legislative oversight and lobbying. There's a natural resources committee. There are a number of women who are active in voter registration, getting the word out, voter education. And so I've been volunteering down there for a while now. But people in my own community on the Wasatch Back here in Park City were really interested in what can we do here? What can we do in our own community? And that's when I approached our president, Linda Sage, and said, what can we do about getting a group here on the Wasatch Back to advocate for voters and citizens back here in Park City and Summit County?
I'm going to ask you a question that you may not have an answer to, but it just occurred to me. Given that Utah had women voting back in the 19th century, were there similar groups prior to the league being formed here in Utah? Do you know anything about that history?
There were a number of groups that kind of came and went. Mm-hmm. And I think they, you know, women started to advocate for the right to vote back in the 1880s.
Right.
And so there were lots of movements in order to try to give women the vote once there was kind of a broad democracy. But it came and went by different names. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, while you're titled the League of Women Voters, the issues that you advocate for are not certainly not solely oriented toward women's issues.
That's exactly right. And men are welcome and invited to join as well. But yeah, really, it's more just broad-based citizens.
And of course, now you've got a Wasatch Back chapter. I take it it's centered here in Park City. Do you also have some participation in Wasatch County from Heber, or are you looking for that?
So it's a Wasatch Back. It's a unit, and so we are still a subsidiary of the Salt Lake League.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we welcome anybody from Summit, Wasatch County, absolutely. And we are still growing. We're really interested in people joining our ranks if they're interested.
Okay, so how many members have you attracted so far? And I take it you are still recruiting.
We're definitely still recruiting, yes. So we have attracted probably about 30 members so far. And people have been on vacation. They come and go. They have a lot of different obligations here in Park City. People are very giving of their time and efforts. And so we have probably a good core group of about 20 people who attending our meetings regularly.
And how often do you have meetings, and what is a typical meeting like?
So we meet every Thursday or every third Tuesday at my house. And a typical meeting consists of brainstorming sessions. We really want to know, we're a fledgling group. And so we are still trying to decide how to center our efforts here. And a typical meeting will consist of brainstorming and what can we do and educating. We've decided to have speakers join us every other meeting and have more of a working meeting every other meeting as well. So we're working on how to write an effective letter to the editor or effectively contact a member of our legislative
delegation
body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Huh, interesting. I have, again, the memories I have, they always had cake at the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, meetings. There's always cake.
That's still true. And of course, is the Tuesday thing, because all election days are on Tuesdays, is that sort of a reminiscent of that?
It wasn't really a sacred thing. It's just what fit into my schedule best.
Okay. I liked my theory better.
I like your theory too.
Okay.
We'll go with that.
Okay. Let's talk about sort of 3 to 5 issues that you and this chapter are really focusing on.
Yeah, so we are really focusing on our efforts on educating the electorate. So we would really like to spread the word out. We'd like to get involved in tabling events and voter registration at local celebrations, festivals, silly market, farmers markets, things like that.
Hey, have you been doing sort of voter signups? Now, is that here in Utah? Can you facilitate a voter registration at a table?
Absolutely can. Yeah, okay. And that's where we're focusing our efforts mostly for now.
Right now,
we've been doing that in Salt Lake forever, and we're trying to get it going off the ground here in the Wasatch Back as well. I did facilitate a tabling event last year at Park Silly. We had a lot of fun. Found that most people who visited were not local, but still, it was a wonderful fun event and kind of a cheerleading session for us because we were so well received, although we didn't sign up a lot of local voters.
And of course, we do have an election coming up this fall. Will you guys be trying to do some of those tabling events at events like Miners Day and other places?
We absolutely are. Yeah, we're hoping. I signed an application the other day to host a table at Miners event. Or in Miners Day, yeah. So yes, we are absolutely. And we're also in coordination with the Proactive League, another active group of women here on the Wasatch Back. We're hosting a candidate intro at the Park City Library on Monday, August 4th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. We've invited all the Park City Council and mayoral candidates to come and just give a kind of a bite-sized intro to us with possibly a little bit of Q&A at the end if there's time. And we're just inviting the public to come and hear what the candidates have to say before the primary, which is on August 12th.
Okay, so we've talked about voter registration. We've talked about the candidate forum. And we'll remind our listeners at the end of this, how to get more information on that. What are some other issues that you hope to tackle as projects this year?
So the other thing that we're hoping to do is create a robust online voter education system through something that the League of Voters has created called Vote 411. So vote411.org is a website that the League has created that is sort of a one-stop shop for people who are interested in registering to vote online, learning if their registration is up to date, changing their address, and also learning about the candidates. So we submit questionnaires to all the local candidates, including for city councils, town councils, school boards, etc. And so I used this as a tool last year when I sat down to fill out my mail-in voter registration to create my voting plan, and it was super helpful to me.
So will you be publishing something like that for people to have access to?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And that will go up. Are you going to try to get something like that up before the primary? When do ballots go out for the primary?
Ballots go out the first of them.
Yeah, they're coming right up.
Yeah, they are, yeah. Okay. So we are probably going to focus on the general election.
It would be hard. First of all, there's too many candidates. A lot of candidates.
People are very concerned this time of year, and the candidate pool has really broadened across the board for local elections.
And are you going to be trying to do that, obviously, here in Park City? Are you going to be trying to do that for Heber as well?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. There are a number of elections for town and city councils in Wasatch and Summit County.
Will the league do that for Salt Lake as well?
Yes.
Okay, so this sounds like a pretty major project.
It is. It's a nationwide project, and we're trying to get grassroots participation across the board.
Okay, any other projects, any other things you're hoping to do once we get past the election season?
Past the election season, then I think we are going to sit back a little bit and do some collaboration with local organizations such as the Proactive Alliance, and we're going to try to educate ourselves on environmental issues, human rights issues, and see where we can make a difference there as well.
And again, at a national level, are there some major issues that the league is pursuing, either legislatively or otherwise?
Yeah, so the league puts out position statements in reaction to executive orders, major executive and legislative initiatives such as the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. The league puts out statements in reaction to all those things, and they also engage in a lot of litigation as well.
Okay, so what kind of litigation has the league filed?
So litigation in terms of executive overreach. So there are civil rights attorneys who at the nationwide level who look at some of these things and support action against what we believe is an overreach.
And you may not know the answer to this, and I maybe remember it wrong, but wasn't the league a plaintiff in one of the cases here in Utah recently? Which one was that?
Yes, yeah, so it was the gerrymandering case.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that is the Better Boundaries.
Exactly.
Okay, so the league is the plaintiff in that case, which I guess went up to the Supreme Court?
It did go up to the Supreme Court.
And where is it now, do you know?
So the Supreme Court actually ruled in favor of the league and our collaborators, which I think included Mormon Women for Ethical Government and maybe one or two other groups as well. And then, they ruled in favor.
Okay. And do you know where that stands? I know it got ruled in favor, and then I believe it got sent back down to the lower court. Do you know when a ruling might actually affect actual congressional districts? Is it possible that will affect the 26 districts?
It probably will, yes.
Probably will. Okay.
Yes, and so we actually, at our next meeting, we've invited Elizabeth Rasmussen to come speak with us, who is the current head of Better Boundaries, and she's going to give us an update on that legislation,
that litigation. Okay, two things before we go. First, is there a website or other place for people to get more information about your chapter?
Yeah, so we have...
Are you part of the Salt Lake?
We're part of the Salt Lake chapter, and that's lwvsl.org. If people want to know more about what we are doing for advocacy, it's lwvutah.org. And at the nationwide level, we are lwv.org.
Okay, and if they want to learn more about your chapter in particular, is there a way to reach you?
They can
email?
Just email me, okay. Yep.
And
which
is
schaefer.m@me.com, and that's schaefer.m@me.com.
And last question, remind our listeners about your upcoming candidate forum.
So our candidate forum is going to be at the Park City Library Community Room on Monday, the 4th of August from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Everybody is welcome.
And at KPCW and the Park Record will also be sponsoring a candidate forum next Tuesday. And I will get the details while we're in a break here, so I make sure you give you the precise time. It will be at the Sandy Auditorium. I believe it's at 6 o'clock. Yes, 6 o'clock on Tuesday. I will double check that, though. Okay, Monica, thanks for being here. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you so much.
Earlier on, I mentioned that KPCW and the Park Record will be hosting a candidate forum. That will be this coming Tuesday, July 22nd. I did get it right. It is at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Santee Auditorium. We've invited all 8 council candidates to join us and have reason to believe they might all show up, so it should be an interesting evening. The Kem C. Gardner Institute at the University of Utah Business School recently released its report on the state of the housing market here in Utah. Here to talk about it on the phone is Dejan Eskick. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Very much appreciate it. Let's talk about some of the key findings. I doubt our listeners will be surprised to hear that Utah housing is expensive. What did the study show from a big picture perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, do you look at the glass half full or glass half empty, right?
Right.
If we go back over the last 5-6 years, obviously we've gotten more expensive, more unaffordable. When we compare to last year, you know, housing prices, rents have kind of stagnated. We got a little bit of an income bump. So we've made some progress, right? So, you know, things have gotten slightly better, but, you know, tell that to the average person looking to buy a house and they're going to laugh in your face probably.
So the sort of the rate of increase is down, although there was still some increase. I imagine that is very different across different sectors of the housing market as well.
Yeah, I mean, the anomaly post-COVID is, you know, you can't find a housing market that didn't appreciate. You know, when we look at the whole country, you know, stagnant places like West Virginia, for example, or Arkansas, those places, their housing costs accelerated. If we look across our state, you know, for post-financial crisis, really the concentration of price appreciation growth was happening in the Wasatch Front, down in Iron and Washington County. And of course, Wasatch Back is sort of its own anomaly that's protected from reality. And so, you know, our rural counties for a better part of the decade were really in a silent recession per se. And then, you know, COVID happens, the work from home phenomenon, you know, we coined the term, not us, but just general society, we coined the term Zoom towns. And that saw our rural markets explode. And those constituents, the longtime residents of those counties all of a sudden went, wait, what just happened? Right. So housing just got out of reach real fast for many people. If we looked at, for example, first time home buyers, so today's renters, for example, in 2019, you know, 51% of renters were able to afford a medium-priced home. Today, about 13% can.
Okay.
So a lot of the market got priced out.
What are those dates again? Yeah, was that 2019 that you could, that 61%?
Yeah.
Wow. And that seems very fast. The other thing is that, and you touched on this when you talked about what's happened in the rural counties. For years, Salt Lake City and Utah in general, it was perceived as this place where you had incredible home values, and it was, you know, possible for you could attract, corporations could attract workers here because housing was cheap. Mm-hmm. That really isn't true anymore. I mean, where are we relative to the rest of the country in terms of housing cost?
Yeah, so we rank ninth in terms of our median sales price. And, you know, like you said before, for a long time, we were in the middle of the pack, right? We were the affordable place. And Utah has this phenomenon of having the youngest workforce, young, well-educated workforce. So, you know, you can translate that into cheaper labor than other states for the dollar per talent or however you want to measure that. And, you know, as it really our acceleration started 2016, 2017, we started noticing, okay, this might be a problem. And then as we get into COVID, you know, we get this, what we often don't talk about is the demographic wave that hit the country, not just Utah, but all states, is when millennials started hitting into their early and mid-30s, forming households wanting to buy homes. You couple that with interest rates that were for a time period sub 3%.
Yeah.
It was the perfect storm. And you know, as scary as COVID was for those first couple of weeks, first few months, you know, the economy stabilized real quick and our job loss recovered really fast, relatively speaking. So, you know, there was fear from a sentiment perspective, but on paper, everything looked good. So we saw just home sales just get absorbed up really, really quickly for a moment there. For example, in April of 2021, 1 in 4 homes that got listed in Utah sold within 24 hours, which was just mind-boggling. So there was just a lot of demand, and then that some of that future demand got pulled up because those interest rates were so low.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about affordability, we talked about it's the ninth most expensive state. Obviously, the relationship between the cost of housing and incomes is critical in terms of determining affordability.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the metrics that you guys try to use to try to understand affordability. How do you compare to what?
Yeah, so you know, the easy one is to compare how incomes and house prices relate to one another. And the easiest way to do that is you take your house price and you divide it by your annual income. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of it recently, you know, in the book Abundance, Ezra Klein kind of talked about this, mm-hmm. how many years of your household income go into a house price? So when it's affordable, it's 3 years of income. And, you know, in the 80s, we were, for example, at like 2.7, 2.5 across the country in majority of our counties. And so in Utah, we started the millennium, you know, year 2000, we were at three. And as a great financial crisis, you know, started taking off and housing prices started taking off, we were hitting into the fours, touching, you know, maybe touching five in some parts of the state. And then, you know, the crash happens, but then we start accelerating, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017. And by 2020, you know, we're touching 5.76 in some places. So meaning now you go from 3 years worth of income to 6 years worth of income. So we've come down a little bit in the last year because our incomes went up, as I said earlier, and our housing prices kind of stagnated, but we're exponentially more, you know, house prices have exponentially left household incomes in the dust in terms of their acceleration. So we've just gotten way more expensive.
And you know, when you talk about 5 years of income, when I combine that with mortgage interest rates between 6% and 7%, that strikes me as a pretty difficult sort of rung for a potential homeowner to reach.
Yeah, and you know, this is an anomaly. We've never had a housing recession, and when I say housing recession, really it's the fall in sales, so fall in consumption of housing. We've never had a housing recession happen during a housing shortage. So in conventional economic terms, when interest rates go up, typically house prices come down.
Right.
And we had a little bit of a recovery. But when you go from 2.5-3% interest rates to 6.5-7%, on paper, your house prices should come down 15-20%. They didn't. You know, we had a blip in our year-over-year price drop, and we're back up into positive territory again. So it just shows that our demographics and our demand is still relatively strong. And when we look at really the anomaly of what makes house prices drop, it's usually something bad that happens. And the first thing is people have to lose their jobs. We have to have a job loss recession in order for house prices to drop. So, you know, people often mistake house prices the same way they look at, for example, the stock market. If they're overvalued, there's a sell-off. We don't sell our houses. You know, you can't go to your wife and kids and say, hey, you know, house prices are coming down. We're going to sell our house and completely destabilize our household, and we're going to move into an apartment and try and play the market and go to a different school district and completely turn our lives upside down so we can take advantage of this. That doesn't happen in housing, right? So typically rent and mortgage eats first, and you're making those payments. The average homeowner is not impacted unless they lose their job, right? So whatever the house market's doing, if you're making your house payment, you're not really impacted by it. It's more of a, if you're trying to buy a house, that's where you really are feeling it.
I suppose another phenomenon that impacts all of this is this effect of having so many homeowners sitting on 2.5% mortgages, such that movement in the housing market, which might normally occur as I have the second or third kid and I want to go to a bigger unit, that's not happening because of this distortion of what I would pay for a new mortgage. Am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, 100%. We've all got the golden handcuffs, and you know, in Utah, approximately, I'll say mid to high 60s% of mortgage holders have a mortgage rate under 4%. And then, you know, we're in the mid 70s, close to 80 on those that have a 5% or lower interest rate. So really today for a homeowner to sell their house, either something great has to happen in their life or something horrible for them to sell their house. And the average homeowner too in Utah has about $270,000 or so of equity in their house. And so, you know, so there's a little nest egg where when we compare that to the great financial crisis, you know, that cushion of equity was not there. So we had a lot of mortgages underwater. Today, you know, it's mid to low single digits across the country and across the state of mortgages that are underwater.
So the study looked at five counties and concluded that housing prices were between seriously to severely unaffordable. First of all, what does that mean, and why did you pick those five?
Yeah, so typically we look at, you know, in terms of sales volume and population growth, right? That's sort of where our concentration is. And then when we're looking at pain points from growth from a policy perspective, which cities are growing, right, or which counties are absorbing that growth, right? It's happening in those five major counties, the four across the Wasatch Front, and then down in Washington County, right? But, you know, the Wasatch Back, you know, Summit, Wasatch, Morgan, those are our three most expensive counties in terms of median sales price. And then when you look at, for example, Summit County by itself, it's out of the 3,000 plus counties in the country, in the first quarter of 2025, Summit County was the 19th most expensive in terms of median sales price. And then, you know, if we take that back to your earlier question of severely unaffordable, you know, that's the measure of how many years of income mm-hmm. going to your house price. So in Summit County, it's close to 10, you know, where the rest of the state is like 5.7, 5.1. I can't quite remember the number off the top of my head this morning. In Summit County, it's like 9. It's in the nines, almost touching 10 in some quarters. So it's exponentially more expensive up there for obvious reason, right? It's one of the major global destination for wealthier homeownership. So you combine that with kind of the dynamics of Summit County, the Wasatch Back, with second homes, short-term rentals, the recreational aspect, right? There's a lot of competition that's more insulated sort of from the day-to-day economics up and down job growth.
You know, it's interesting. That number between 9 and 10, you mentioned that Summit County might be the 19th most expensive county in the country. Do you by any chance know where that 9 to 10 puts us relative, you know, that ratio relative to other counties? Are we not only one of the most expensive, but also one of the most unaffordable?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but when we think of like a New York, an LA, a San Francisco, those are in the low teens terms of, yeah. You're in the top 1% both from a income and an affordability ranking.
Something tells me that we probably get outrun by Teton County as well, but it's neither here nor there. Okay, what trends are we seeing, given the cost of housing and the traditional family home, are we seeing more multifamily units being constructed here in Utah?
Excuse me. Yeah, I mean, the last decade was really the decade of multifamily construction in Utah. You know, we saw tens of thousands of units be constructed, be built, and really since, for example, the first tax package when we got opportunity zones across the country, which are these, you know, neglected areas of our cities and our communities, we incentivized investment into those communities. So for example, downtown Salt Lake City is an opportunity zone. We saw exponential growth in apartment construction since like 2017, 2018. And really throughout COVID, you know, you look at the skyline of downtown, there's still cranes moving and building new apartment buildings. And so we've overbuilt the apartment market in Utah, and especially in concentrated areas. So what we've seen is in some places we would have 3 years worth of supply be coming online at any one point in time. And so that's now finishing construction. Those units are being put up to the market to rent, and there's not enough renters. So we're seeing rents pull back. So we're seeing new projects offer, you know, 1-2 months free rent. There's not much rent growth happening in most apartment buildings. So we kind of have this Goldilocks period of a little bit of a break where rents have deaccelerated and incomes have grown year over year, right? So our affordability on rentals has incrementally improved. But to say that, you know, from the rent growth we experienced in terms of dollar value from 2020 to 2023 is the same dollar value we experienced from 2010 to 2020.
Wow.
Right. So we had 10 years worth of rent acceleration happen in those 3 years.
Okay. Before we go, can you touch briefly on your 2025 housing forecast?
I mean, it is a dull market, for lack of a better word. Without something dramatic happening in the economy one way or another, I don't think much happens to prices or rent for 2025. We're just kind of in the same holding pattern we have been for the past 2 years. So I don't see prices doing much one way or another. You know, you could make an easy assumption that they might go up a percent or drop a percent down, but not much is going to happen in terms of house prices because of how high interest rates are. Yeah. We're not going to really get a lot of more new supply. So supply is tight. And so that's going to put upward pressure on prices. Now, if we get some softening in the job market, that might pull prices down a little bit. But again, because there's no significant new supply coming to keep up with our population expectation growth for this year and next year, we don't expect prices to move in either direction significantly.
Okay. We've been talking. Is it Dejan? Did I pronounce that correctly?
It's day on, like day on, day off.
There we go. So day on, we hope you get a day off, and we'll come back and talk about this again next year.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, day on. Have a good day. Joining me in the studio now is Brian Stevens. He's the Summit Mosquito Abatement District Manager. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Brian, what is the Mosquito Abatement District? We're familiar with lots of subdivisions of Summit County, but this is one I never focused on before this morning.
Yeah, we're a district within Summit County that... basically, our job is to go around through the county and conducting surveillance and basically trying to suppress. We can't completely eradicate, but we try to suppress mosquito populations throughout the county.
That's what I was going to ask you. It's probably impossible to eradicate mosquitoes. How do we define an optimal mosquito level?
I guess it's...
Not on my arm is one definition.
Yeah, I guess it's different for everybody. Sure. I mean, optimal for someone would be not getting bit at all, but optimal for another person would be, and I always see a few here and there, and that we can tolerate that, but...
Are there metrics that define this, mosquitoes parts per million or some number?
We're conducting... We do trapping regularly, so we kind of got a feel for what's out there in the county, but as far as, defining it that that confined, we really haven't done that.
It would actually be kind of hard to do that, I suspect.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because they change, things change every year.
Exactly.
You know, one spot could be good 1 year, and then next year it could be not so good. So yeah.
Now we all think of mosquitoes as pests. Do they also present a health risk here in the county?
Absolutely. We have our biggest concern is West Nile virus. You know, there's other diseases that mosquitoes carry, but our biggest concern is West Nile virus. We do have the mosquito, it's called Culex mosquito, that carries that disease. We regularly send mosquitoes down to the state lab for testing. So we stay on top of, are we seeing any of that in the county? And at this point, we haven't had any reports.
Have we seen West Nile virus in the county in the past?
We have it's been a long time ago. Okay. It's been a while. It's rare that we do have mosquitoes that report with West Nile, or it's rare that we have a human case, or even rare that we have horse cases, things like that.
Horse case.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, and West Nile virus, I take it as a serious health issue.
It is. Okay. Yeah. It's neuroinvasive.
Okay.
And it causes, for most people, it's causes flu-like symptoms, but for some people it can get into the brain and things like that and really have some devastating effects. So
let's talk. So you're monitoring the population almost through various techniques.
Yeah.
Then what kinds of activities do you actually undertake, and how does it work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our primary thing that we do is we really mosquitoes, they're aquatic. They start in the water.
Okay.
And so they have...
Are they born in the water?
They're born in the water. So they hatch in the water, and then they go through various stages. They go through a larval stage and then a pupa stage. And when they pupate, that's when they hatch, and then they become airborne. Okay. So we really try to catch them in the water. That's the optimal way to get them, is in the water. So we're going around. We have folks going around throughout the whole county. They're going finding water sources and dipping water sources, looking for larvae, and then they treat that source with something that knocks them out.
Is the ideal mosquito breeding ground some kind of small body of still water? Is that where they live?
Yes.
Is that where they hatch?
Yeah, honest, kind of depends on the mosquito species, but stagnant water, they like that. They'll hatch in that. Some mosquitoes will hatch on, like, mud and things like that. And then when the water comes up to the... to the mud and things like that, then that's when they'll hatch. So it's just depending on the species. There's some the malaria mosquito, the Fribornae, they like actually clear water. So it's just interesting. They have all their different likes and dislikes as mosquito species. So yeah.
Kind of like people.
Kind of like people, absolutely, yeah.
So it's a big county, right?
Big county.
How do you go around finding, I mean, do you send people, you know, looking through open areas, looking for bodies of stagnant water? Is that how you operate?
Yeah, we've got our county carved up into certain areas. We have about 13 areas in the county that we've carved it up. We have people in each of those areas. And we have a GPS system that we use. So we pretty much know where the water is,
right.
But that changes, you know, as we have developments, as storms come, we have a wet winter, things like that. It's just very dynamic, but we, for the most part, have it all mapped out, and then those people kind of go rotate around their area looking for mosquitoes in that area.
And how many employees do you have?
We have about 22, 23.
And how, and then when you find them, what do you do?
Well, we use it's called a larvicide. It's actually it's kind of biofriendly. It's a bacteria that's been kind of honed to treat mosquito populations. So it's very targeted. So, you know, other
doesn't
things
bother
in the water.
Other things.
Yeah, other things
oh,
in the water,
cool.
It really kind of doesn't affect. But, you know, there will be some larvae that it will affect, but it's really targeted more
so
than mosquitoes.
It's kind of like a smart bomb for mosquitoes.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Very cool. Now, where do you see the biggest sort of concentrations of this kind of stagnant water here in the county?
Stagnant water, a lot of it happens on irrigated fields where they'll irrigate, yeah. The water will sit for a bit,
yeah.
Things like that. You know, mosquitoes don't like the moving water, you know, they don't want to lay in that. The reservoirs can pose problems if they get up high into what we call the mosquito beds, because then the rippling effect is no longer taking place. They don't like the rippling effect, but once it gets up into grass and things like that.
Like
then,
by the side of the Jordan.
Exactly
now,
right.
Side
of the shores up into the tall grass areas where the rippling stops, then that becomes problematic. And honestly, any person's home can have stagnant water. Yeah. You know, there's some things around their home that could collect water. So
now, do you get tips? Do people call and say, "Hey, I see some pieces, some stagnant water with apparent mosquito infestation"?
Yeah, we just ask them, check around their spot, check around their place. You know, if there's dog dishes are notorious. Animal troughs are notorious. Boat covers are notorious. You know, the dip. The dip.
Wow. Okay.
The, you know, old tires. They love old tires because old tires heat up very quickly and they migrate to those. Absolutely. So yeah.
Okay. So if listeners want to let you know about something they see, what do they do?
They can give us a call.
Okay.
They can give us a call at 435-336-2088. We have staff there that will take their information down, and we'll send somebody out to take a look. Yeah.
Okay, Brian, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Nope, I don't think so. Just thanks for having me here and just getting the word out of, you know, just be vigilant when you're out at night, you know, where if you're kind of in areas where you may see mosquitoes, wear long sleeves, long pants, things like that. Yep.
And I'm sorry we're on the radio only for this instance. Brian has on a fabulous hat with this great logo of the Summit County Mosquito District. It has a picture of a mosquito with a red circle and a line through it.
Eliminate him. Get rid of him.
All right, Brian, thanks for joining us this
morning.
Thanks
so much. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this. On the phone, we have KPCW's President and General Manager, Juliana Alley, to talk about what's going on in Congress and how it might affect us here in Park City at KPCW. Morning, Juliana.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for making some time for me and for this very late-breaking news. It's been a really fluid process this spring and summer, and hard to keep up with all the activities in Washington, D.C., and how they're going to impact the public media system, and more importantly, how KPCW will be impacted. But fortunately, the end is in sight. It's not the end we were hoping for.
I don't know if I would say fortunately, Juliana, but the end is in sight.
Well, yeah, this back and forth has been pretty exhausting. I'm happy to be in the East Coast right now, which is why I'm calling in. And so I've actually been able to keep up with it a little bit easier, possibly, than being in Mountain Time. But yeah, we are expecting that President Trump's going to resign that rescission package defunding the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You know, CPB is the entity, the nonprofit entity that allocates the federal appropriation to public media stations, and KPCW is one of those stations. So we're now looking at a cash shortfall of $264,000 for fiscal 26 as well as for 27. But along with that, those cash dollars, that outright grant, and we're still figuring this out, KPCW, you know, is part of that network, and CPB provides shared resources for the public media system. And that those two main things is the infrastructure that delivers emergency alerts to local stations. Those are critical alerts such as wildfires, avalanches, and other public safety messages. And secondary to that is CPB negotiates and pays the music licensing rights for stations, non-commercial radio stations like KPCW. So we got to get our arms around that as well and figure out how we're going to manage that going forward. That's not just a dollar outlay. That's going to be a resource outlay as well, you know, because it was something that CPB negotiated on behalf of all of the non-commercial stations. And so we've got some homework to do to figure that out.
Now, is it clear that CPB will no longer have sufficient funds to do that, or are they just taking a budget hit like we are?
I believe that they will not have any more funding. There is only one revenue stream for CPB, okay. And it is the federal appropriation. They are nonprofit, independent. They cannot lobby. They cannot fundraise. The only revenue stream for them is a federal appropriation. And you know, that of that appropriation, they only kept 5% for themselves to run and administer their overhead.
Okay. So that's a resource loss. Do we have any understanding about the potential impact on NPR? Because I know we do. Obviously, KPCW does get programming from NPR. Are they losing some of their funding?
Yes, they will lose some funding because of that appropriation. It was about 1-2% that NPR received. So for them, it's a speed bump, maybe. Mm-hmm. But, again, a cash speed bump. As far as a meaningful and an effort and a resource issue, you know, because NPR, while they are the overarching news organization, we are a community and a network of local stations. It is the far-flung stations in the Four Corners area, in Alaska, in rural Maine, and KUER, you know, covering those far-flung areas in Utah. That is really what is at risk here and is of great concern. So while NPR, and they're being generous, their board has already decided to release some emergency funding to the stations that are more at risk. You know, KPCW, we're that 264, that's a really big number, but we're a bit lucky that it's only 14-15% of our operating budget. And while that's going to sting, and we're going to have to be creative about how we budget, you know, the Board of Trustees and I, we've got some homework to do. We got our pencils to sharpen to figure out how we're going to allocate our resources. But we also think we can identify some new revenue streams. And we know we can. Already the community is coming out for us. You guys have been answering those calls for activation. You've been reaching out to your lawmakers and letting them know about the importance of KPCW and the importance of public media. We so appreciate that effort. And we also appreciate you guys showing up for us with donations. You know, this month is our 45th birthday, and we've already been getting, you know, some great outreach with those birthday messages and those birthday donations. We're hoping that the community will continue to come out for KPCW and show their support.
Yep, cards and chocolate are nice, but we would also appreciate donations for our birthday. Juliana, we talked about the shortfall. Is that going to hit? Which budget year does that hit? Is that going to hit us this year, or will that be next year and the years after, or both?
Well, both. It'll technically hit us next year, but next year is only 6 weeks away for us. Our fiscal year end is August 31st. So September 1st, we'll turn the page, and we will not have that $264,000.
Okay. Juliana, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Yeah, I just want to, again, thank all of the outreach. Protect My Public Media, who has tracked millions of phone calls, emails, and outreach of concerned citizens who are reaching out to their lawmakers and letting them know the importance of public media. I also have to thank the KPCW team, including you, Roger, everybody who's just done a tremendous job helping us message this unfolding situation and how it's going to impact the station. I just so appreciate the KPCW team and so appreciate this community that we get to serve.
Okay, Juliana, thanks for calling in.
You bet.
We'll be right back after this. I want to once again remind you of the candidate forum that KPCW and the Park Record will be doing. That's Tuesday night at the Jim Sani Auditorium from 6 to 8. We anticipate that we know that all of the 8 city council candidates have been invited. I sort of suspect that most, if not all of them, are going to show up. Monday on Mountain Money, we've got a really interesting show. We're going to spend some time with an AEI, American Enterprise Institute economist, and some time with the author of a book called Waiting for Britney Spears. It's about one man's career as a paparazzi.